Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, it's always fun to talk about birds with today's guest, Bill Volker. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator, a naturalist. He worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years, written some books, and has led many birdwatching tours. Always fun to talk with him, and if you have questions, I hope you will join in. Which birds do you love to watch migrate every spring? Maybe you need help identifying a bird. Join the conversation. You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Bill Volker, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, Larry, it's a real pleasure and really nice to be here in person with you again. It's been quite a long time.
Been a long time. It's great to see you in the flesh. Here we got spring. This morning I looked out on my lawn where there's no snow anymore, and there were a half a dozen robins.
I hear reports of them showing up. I have not seen them yet, but certainly expect them. And the last about 10 days, we've been seeing some of the very early arrivals. Canada geese have started to show up. It's about a week and a half ago. Then the sandhill cranes coming in. A lot of them flying overhead. Some of them are on territory and calling. So they're quite vocal and pretty well making their presence known. In the last few days, I had a single red-winged blackbird at a feeder, and driving down here today, several flocks of them. So they're starting to move in mass. And even yesterday, I had at least three or four killdeer up high. Could hear them calling, and they're on the move. These are sort of that very early advance of birds. They're responding to the receding of the snow. So especially southern Wisconsin, as our snow is starting to melt and we're getting some open space, that's what's making access to food available. We're going to see now during March and into early April, depending on the weather a little bit and the progress of spring, we'll be seeing things will slow down. These first birds will get here, take advantage of the changing the environment, and then it's going to take a little while. When the ice starts to finally thaw, and of course that's a ways away now, that's when, of course, the ducks and other water birds will start to advance north. And then not until we get into the end of April and especially the month of May, as we start to see insect hatches, that's the food for the songbirds, and those birds will be making migrations all the way back from Central and Northern South America.
Yeah, so they're coming. They're coming. I wanted to mention, and we have callers online, Chris and Kelly, we'll get to you in just a minute, but I did want to mention something about bird flu. Of course, we've got the price of eggs in the market, supermarkets, a lot more expensive than usual, and I think avian flu is responsible for a lot of that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I think for most people, they're probably more aware of the increase in the price of eggs than they are the actual cause, which is the fact that millions of chickens died or either were infected and died, or you just cannot allow that sort of epidemic to run its course. They basically have to exterminate a flock just so that it doesn't lead to long-term infections of the virus. And certainly it's had this direct impact on our lives, that the loss of the chicken flocks and the egg production. But there's also been impact to our wild birds. This past summer, we saw the Caspian tern, which is a threatened species in Wisconsin, it is our largest tern on the Great Lakes. And in a breeding colony, almost two-thirds of the breeding adults died.
And
why it affected those birds so severely, well, certainly they're a colonial nester, so it can spread easily in a group of birds that are nesting in close proximity to each other. But in a way, it reminds me also of West Nile virus when that first came in the early 2000s. There were some birds like jays and crows that were seriously hit and, of course, then developed an immunity and responded by seeing a slow increase in their numbers. But others' birds were not. And that's really the unknown, is when you've got 300 species of birds that are of somewhat regular occurrence in Wisconsin, which ones are predisposed to these kinds of epidemics far more than others? And if we have something that is already endangered by other environmental factors, so for example, the whooping crane that we have so few of, very slow to mature and very slow to add any young to their population, raising usually just one, maybe two chicks a year, and that's after 5 years of age that they even begin to breed, and they're not always successful. Well, you can have very slow progress of a buildup and a very rapid impact and decline. So it's not gone. And in a way, I think of avian influenza as kind of like the flu cold season. For us, that starts in fall and winter. These types of epidemics are more summer.
Yeah.
So it's a seasonal thing, and the birds are coming back, and this might just start to kind of rear its head too. And we're keeping our fingers crossed that it's not going to be too serious for our native birds, but it's a big unknown. And in a sense, I think we can easily relate to this, having just gone through a COVID pandemic.
Yeah.
These are an epidemic for our birds. And scientists are speculating that perhaps some of these types of epidemics are becoming a little bit more prevalent, maybe a little more severe, because of ecosystem instability. We have just fragmented and impacted ecosystems that just don't seem to hold together and function and maybe buffer themselves. We don't know. These are speculations. You know, ecosystems are just so complex and so many multiple variants working. We don't know, and you couldn't even begin to model all the interactions. But it seems that perhaps that instability within these natural systems, this might be a spinoff from it.
Bill Volkert, our guest. Bill, you mentioned crows, and Chris in Black Creek has a question relating to crows.
All right.
Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Bill. I'm really glad you mentioned crows. I had two crows at different times, and both of them are incredibly smart, as you know. And my second one, Jay, he would ride on my shoulder. All I'd have to do is tell him to stay on my shoulder. In and out of grocery stores, people would want to pet him like a dog. And so I'd be like, well, I got to ask Jay if you can pet him. And he'd look at me right on my shoulder, and then he'd put his head down and let him pet him. Let them pet, you know, the bird. And he loved shiny things, as you know, Bill. And we would play with a silver nickel or something like that in the yard and challenge each other on who could get to it first. And so people should keep in mind, don't leave your shiny car keys on the picnic table. You know, so... my question is, I could find this out myself, I'm sure, Google it. But, Bill, is it still illegal to have a native indigenous crow in the state of Wisconsin?
Yes, it is, without special permit. So there are federal permits that are allowed for zoos, for example, and those are kept under permit. And even for, say, a taxidermist to put it into a museum or something like that. Those are things that, you know, you require a special permit to even be able to keep that. So, yes, it's under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And so this is a federal law. We're going back to 1916. And it basically says that all migratory birds are protected by federal law, and you cannot possess them or molest those birds. So, yes, it is illegal to do so, unfortunately.
There you go, Chris. Yep. Thanks very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Kelly in Suamico. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I lived north of Green Bay on a portion of Green Bay referred to as Dead Horse Bay. And one of the lifelong residents, every year, right before the ice would start to break up on Dead Horse Bay, swans would appear. And very limited numbers, but one of the lifelong residents had told me that they came in troves, tens of thousands of them, in the 80s. And I asked my uncle, who is a retired Wisconsin DNR officer, about it, and he said that there was a mass die-off, and that they were putting dump truck loads of them into the landfills and caring for them at Horicon and everything. I was wondering if you could elaborate what this event was, and, you know, if so, how many birds were affected by it?
That was in the 80s, Bill.
Yeah, well, good question. Actually, I think you're talking about two separate events. I myself, I'm not aware of the tundra swans being impacted by any disease outbreak or lead poisoning to that degree. There was around Horicon Marsh lead poisoning and also epidemics where birds were being picked up literally by the dump truck full. And again, just like with the chickens, to break that cycle when you've got thousands of birds concentrated on a wildlife area during migration, the way to break that cycle is to gather those carcasses as quickly as possible and to remove those so you can kind of slow things down. Tundra swans, yes, Green Bay was always a big stopover point. And in general, the swan population, which migrates across the United States, has been fairly stable. The stopovers at places like Green Bay, I've certainly heard that there's been quite a decline over the decades. A friend of mine, Tom Erdman, is up in that very same area and has been doing research on birds for many years up there and has much greater direct experience with pelicans, swans, and others in that location. I have heard from him that, yes, years ago, there were big stopovers of the swans. We're not seeing it the same. Swans with those long necks are reaching into the shallow water for vegetation and tubers and roots. And oftentimes it's siltation and changes in the substrate and the lack of food that reduces the concentrations of those birds. The Mississippi River still hosts a pretty good migration. And that's a bird that'll be showing up here within the next few weeks. And you can both look overhead to see the flocks of swans, and I just love to hear them as they're coming. It's not such a raucous, sharp call as a Canada goose, but more of a soft moan, and that's usually how we detect them. And oftentimes they'll even, with a good wind, migrate at night, and you may step outside after sunset and hear them. So the next 2 to 3 weeks, watch and listen for tundra swans.
I think Trina's got a tundra song. Is that really a tundra swan?
That's trumpeter swan.
That's trumpeter swan. Yeah. That's not a tundra swan.
Old name, whistling swan.
Well, maybe we can find that.
But it's, I would describe it as a soft moaning. It's a very pleasant song.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see if we can find that. But in the meantime, let me remind you, Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. Great to have him with us. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at birds and bird migrations today with our guest Bill Volkert, DNR naturalist. Clara Neipert's our producer, by the way, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. And Trina has found a tundra swan, so let's hear the tundra swan.
That latter part is usually what you're going to hear.
Yeah.
Some of that recording, the birds were a little closer. You're hearing a little bit of a cluck in the voice. Usually when they're high overhead, it's just, as I describe it, a soft moaning sound, and you can hear them coming from a long way. The next 3 weeks, pay attention, and especially when we get an east wind. Mm. And the swans are very unusual because most birds go south for migration and more or less go straight north. So a lot of our waterfowl are down along the Gulf Coast and even into Central America or Mexico, and head up into Wisconsin, Canada, and the Dakotas for nesting. The swans are wintering off the East Coast, Chesapeake Bay and along Delaware. And they'll come across just south of the Great Lakes, stop in Wisconsin, and then they'll start to make a turn. Part of the population goes north toward Hudson Bay, and others continue to Alaska. So they're diagonal across the country, and Wisconsin's really where they make their turn. So, yeah, do watch for them. They're spectacular.
Ken in Beaver Dam, we go to you. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I'm wondering if birds migrate to the same location every year, like robins or red-winged blackbirds.
That's a good question. In fact, if we go back to the days of John James Audubon in about the 1840s, he's credited as the first person in North America to band or mark a bird. It was a little Phoebe, one of our flycatchers, that was nesting on his cabin. So he put a little silver wire around its leg and found the very next year the exact same individual was back. And I've got a federal license as well for bird banding. People who mark birds do see the birds coming back that way to the same place. And essentially, it's if it worked the previous year, instinct tells them to come back to those areas. And if they were successful in nesting in one year, they're certainly going to do that again. With longer-lived birds like Canada geese, if they successfully raise the family in one year, they'll come back and oftentimes use right in that same area nest. If they have a failure, look for a different place that seems safer for them. Mm-hmm. It does come up with a little bit of a problem, though. And this is something that's arisen in past programs. I've had people say, you know, I've been living at this house for 20 years, and every spring I look out the same tree, there's a robin. Is it the same one? Well, every robin in the world looks the same, so we really can't identify individuals unless they're specifically marked. We do know the general trend is to come back to the same site every year, but on average for songbirds, 3 to 5 years is a life expectancy for many of them. A lot of them will live 8 to 10 years, so there's this more rapid turnover rate in the population among individuals. But yes, generally that is that instinct to come back to their natal home. And for some birds, we don't even know how they navigate and fly there. A good example here is the sandpipers. They go to the Arctic to nest, and we will see the males return to Wisconsin late June and July. They'll go up there, find a mate, establish a territory, and then they'll abandon the family and fly down here because the female is just providing guardianship. She doesn't have to feed the young, just lead them to where the food is. Well, then later in the summer, the females take off, and for some species, the young will migrate independently of the adults. How do they know where they're going if they've never been there before? And yet they have a very specific migratory route and a wintering range. There is something that's pre-programmed for some of these birds that we just don't understand. And I guess we just shrug it off as, well, that's instinct. Which, yes, yeah. That kind of explains it, but it also means we haven't got a clue of how they do it. But that's the mystery of migration. There are a lot of unknowns.
Ken, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Dennis in Two Rivers, we'll go to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Years back, my dad built what would pretty much be like a condominium for purple martins and thought, well, with the avian flu, maybe multiple units like that wouldn't be good to put together. And I think, Bill, you said something like terns are having a trouble because maybe we should have a breeding program for beneficial terns because one good tern deserves another.
You're absolutely right. Well, you've got some good concerns that maybe if purple martins are susceptible to an epidemic, that a colonial nester like that might be more vulnerable. If you have enough colonies spread out, if it is impacting one, hopefully there's enough others that are successful and are insulated from that. Purple martins are a bird that really does require some assistance and management from us. In the eastern United States, they are 100% wholly dependent on human-made cavities, sites, the purple martin house. It's our housing is all they're using. Out west, there are still some known sites where large hollowed-out trees may host a colony. But this is a bird that has been declining quite a bit over the decades. And one of the real problems is that invasion by house sparrows and starlings. And unless colonies are actively managed, that people are intentionally trying to, one, lure them to the site and trying to keep the invaders out, you can lose that colony. And I've had people tell me they just didn't have the heart and just could not get in there to try to remove the house sparrows and starlings. Well, you're not going to have both. It's one or the other. And I would certainly give the space to the purple martins. So if anybody's interested to try to help them out, I would strongly suggest looking at the website Purple Martin Conservation Association. They've got wonderful plans for buying houses or gourds, how to put them up, where to, how to manage them, and give it a try. It can take several years to try to attract them. Usually people who live near open bodies of water, because there's a lot of food and open space, can't put it in a forest. It's got to have an open aspect for them to fly in and out. But all that information should be available on the website there. And maybe a few people will give it a try to help purple martins out.
There you go. Thank you very much for that question. Celia in Madison, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for this program. Just one quick bird fact and two comments, and your comments on any of it. I lived in New York for 40 years and on the west side, so it was four avenues on both sides of me, and had a job where I would get home like 11 o'clock at night. And in the West Pocket Park, across from me, I could hear a cardinal calling at 11 o'clock at night. So I finally went around to the bird clinic and I said, why is this bird calling at 11 o'clock at night? And they told me that the cars on both avenues made so much noise during the day, any other bird wouldn't be able to hear him to mark his territory. That's why he marked his territory at 11 o'clock at night.
Oh, that's curious. He was just being drowned out during the day.
And is there any program in Wisconsin which leads blind children bird sighting by sound? And please bring birdnote.org back to NPR.
I don't know about specific programs for people who are either blind or visually impaired, specifically in Wisconsin, but I have read about some programs that have been starting up around the country. And so there may be something in Wisconsin I'm not aware of, but this is somewhat emerging to try to help other people to enjoy birds who may have some limitations or disabilities, mm-hmm. but still be able to share in that.
Yeah, and I don't know of any either off the top of my head. The Association Wisconsin, there's a blind mm-hmm. association in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And it might even be worth a quick look over there.
Just reading about somebody doing this, but it was in another state. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that ideas like that, a good idea like that, will start to spread.
Celia, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Artie, who's north of Green Bay. Hi, Artie.
Hi. I had a starling in my bird feeder this morning, and I was just wondering, did he just migrate here, or do they stay around in the wintertime?
We will see starlings remain throughout the winter, obviously where there's some shelter and food. So when we do the Christmas bird counts in late December, we'll be picking up flocks of them. When I drive around, usually around the farmyards is where I'll see a concentration of them, especially where there's an open silo or a feedlot. But there is a migratory behavior. They'd have picked that up in the United States. It is an introduced bird, of course. And so, yes, there is some movement. Yesterday, I saw the first small flock of red-winged blackbirds. Prior to that, it was only a single bird that visited feeder 2 days before that. And as I took a quick look with my binoculars, I could see there were two starlings. So in other words, there's a mixed flock.
Yeah.
And you will see in the next couple of weeks, red-winged blackbirds are early arrivals. Cowbirds, grackles, and starlings may also mix in with them as they're moving around and joining the migration.
Artie, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Tom and Oconto, we'll go to you next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Give you some information on the swans at Green Bay. Historically, you had the birds wintering in Chesapeake Bay, mm-hmm. and from there they would had very few places that they would stop. Saginaw Bay, Green Bay, Lake Winnebago, Red Lake, Minnesota, and then they go up to Lake Manitoba and northward. Disney actually took film out here in Green Bay in the late 50s, Earl Wright from the Neville Museum, because it was one of the few places you could see tundra swans. What happened is, number one, you did have a lead poisoning problem, which was worked out, I think, with Dick Hunt and Bob Cook, who was then at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. And they're the ones that analyze the birds from Lake Winnebago and from Green Bay. Duck hunter shooting in the fall, of course, kept the birds away from where they had their decoys and they were shooting. But in the spring, the birds would come back and forage in the exact same areas mm-hmm. in front of the blinds and things, and that's where the lead poisoning came in. In the late 60s, birds in Chesapeake Bay, they ended up with a large population of mute swans, which were eating up the vegetation for the wintering birds there. And the swans started flying out with the Canada geese and the mallards into cornfields. And that spread, especially after 73, we had a tremendous storm that took out all the submergent and emergent vegetation on the lower bay. And the birds started going out to the cornfields. And that's why now they will stop a little bit in the spring, but they're going over to Shiocton and Seymour, Wisconsin. There's DNR land over there, and that's where the big concentrations are, where you can see 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 swans at a time. And the whole migration route has, we have swans going through Illinois now and southern Wisconsin, everywhere. Any place there's corn, that's what they're foraging on, just like the Canada geese that nest in the Arctic move up into Wisconsin about this time of year, and they start foraging in the harvested fields, too.
Yeah, some interesting...
I appreciate that history, yes.
Yeah, that's a great history, Tom. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it.
It was nice to hear about the work of Dick Hunt. He was a close colleague of mine, the head waterfowl researcher for DNR at Horicon Marsh.
Yeah. Tom, thank you so much. Bill in Elm Grove, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, Bill's on. And listen, we spent a lot of winters in Florida. Never saw a robin or a redwood blackbird. Mm-hmm. So where do they migrate to in the winter from Wisconsin?
Yeah, good question. We believe that the Wisconsin red-winged blackbirds comprise a lot of the big flocks in Tennessee and Kentucky. We've never really marked them specifically to see just where, but they do have large winter flocks, and it's assumed they're coming from the Midwest. Robins tend to go down toward Oklahoma, Arkansas, eastern Texas. So, yeah, where Florida certainly is a wintering site for other birds, it is not for those two birds out of Wisconsin.
Yeah, interesting. Bill, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Steve in Adams County, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi. I was listening to you guys talking about the early returners returning, and you mentioned sandhill cranes. Now, we've got a couple of sandhill cranes that are, you know, regular residents nearby here, and I was just thinking about that, and I turned the corner onto my local street, and sure enough, there was one slowly strutting his way across. I stopped the car and waited for him to slowly strut across the street. But I don't think he's one of the original pairs because he's a little more silvery colored. The other ones, our regulars, are kind of brown.
And this one was seen by itself, right?
Yeah. Well, I only saw the one.
Mm-hmm. And maybe the other one, maybe the mate was hiding further back from view, or what you have is a non-breeder. Cranes, it's going to take about 4 or 5 years before they're old enough to actually mate. The pairs are back very quickly, and they are out there bugling in unison. That's what you're hearing right now. They're reclaiming those territories and reaffirming their breeding commitment. So, yeah, the adults are back already, and then the young are following them. What happens is this is part of the learning the migratory route. There is learning involved. The young will follow this apparent south, and then we'll come back north with them, and then they'll chase them off at this time of the year. And then you're going to see some of these lone cranes flying in circles and calling. They'll eventually make up bachelor flocks of others of their own kind. But I always think of it as, you know, the young kid who just got kicked out of the family, and it's like, well, Mom, why don't you like me anymore? And he's out there somewhat lost in calling. So you'll see that behavior of breeding pairs and then these non-breeders, birds from the previous years that are forming these large flocks. They'll be independent, and then, of course, the young ones that will eventually be joining the bachelor flocks.
Speaking of sandhills, John had emailed and wondered what happened to the two small 10 to 12 bird flocks of sandhills heading over north over Waukesha the week of the 12-inch snowstorm up north. This seemed early. Usually these flocks are dozens or over 100 birds.
Yeah, there were some birds that, even in my neighborhood, they showed up just a few days before the last snowstorm. Fortunately, this time of year, even if you get an 8 or 12-inch snowstorm, we've got some pretty good warmth in the sun. Sun's a little bit higher in the sky, and the snow does not hang on that long. And I think the cranes probably know that. They can withstand a pretty good storm, and they can bear it and wait for things, you know, to pass over. If you get that kind of a snow in January, well, it can last for weeks, which is why they're not here. But at the first chance, they're coming back up, and sometimes it surprises me that some of these birds seem to be arriving sooner than I would think is wise as far as the weather, but they know better than me. They've been around a lot longer. So, yeah, they can tough that out for a storm or two.
And we've got a sandhill. It's always fun to hear the sandhill cranes. Trina's got
that
one
bugling
for us. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a single bird calling. Usually you'll hear at this time of year one single note and then this gurgle after it. And that's the unison call, male, female, that are actually synchronizing. They're calling together. And what was discovered out at the International Crane Foundation many decades ago was that this is absolutely critical to nesting, not just as a behavior for a pair bond, but the fact is that this is what physiologically stimulates the ovulation, so the female is even receptive to mating. So it actually sets the stage, both sort of physically and psychologically, for the birds to start a nesting season all over again.
Very cool. Greg in Wauwatosa, your turn. Hi, Greg.
Hello. When I was a boy in the suburbs of New Orleans in the 1960s and 70s, we would have an annual migration of cedar waxwings. And they would generally come when it got very cold. In fact, I remember distinctly when we had snow and ice, the few times that we did, the cedar waxwings were still there in mass. And we had a large hackberry tree in our yard, as well as holly trees with holly berries, and they would just devour these things. But as time went on toward the 80s and 90s, and I moved away to the Midwest, but that stopped. And I was wondering what might have become of cedar waxwings, because I haven't seen any up here as well.
Oh, you haven't. Cedar waxwings, I don't know of any, say, significant decline continentally. I may have been some changes down in New Orleans I'm not aware of. But they're an interesting bird because summertime, they're eating on insects. And you'll see them along lake shores and rivers on the trees, and it'll be sallying out, flying out and snapping insects out of the air. It's a very protein, fat-rich food for them and their young. But as we get into fall and the insects, the populations start to die back, they shift over to fruit. Now, we will have waxwings that are sighted throughout the wintertime in Wisconsin if they can find a food source. A big one is crabapples, something that will last long enough on the tree and will even freeze. They can eat that and survive on it. Other native fruits, they're usually eaten up or even fall from the shrubs pretty quickly as we get into the early part of winter. So those food sources tend to diminish pretty quickly for them. And so these are birds that at that time of year become nomads. They're looking for wherever that food is. I've had flocks on Christmas bird counts numerous years, and also years where they are just not sighted. And we do know some of our birds will migrate down toward Texas in some winters. And I think this really has a lot to do with the weather and available food. And for like any fruit tree, you know, it can be a good year and a bad year for production, too.
Sure.
So they'll respond accordingly.
And we've got a cedar waxwing song there.
Very thin call.
Yeah.
It's a really high, thin call, and it just doesn't carry very far. Once you get an ear for it, it's easy to pick out overhead. But, yeah, it's something that it takes a little bit to get familiar with.
You can, thanks, Greg, by the way. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@WPR.org. But if you call, we'll get you on pretty quickly. Camille in New Berlin emailed. She has a large Colorado blue spruce that used to be referred to as the bird condo. She had the tree sprayed for needle drop disease with a fungicide, myclobutanol. And they assured Camille that this would not harm the birds, but do they abandon the nest when these trees are sprayed? It's an abandoned condo now.
Well, you've got two things. One, it may be used by a pair or two of birds as a nesting site during summertime, and if it doesn't have a direct physical impact of whatever it's being sprayed with, just the disturbance itself may chase the birds out of there to abandon the nest. But a dense shrub or a tree like that, it's also shelter throughout the summer and wintertime. So it is a great place to hide from predators, from the weather, and overnight it's a roost site. So, yeah, you do have that benefit. Of course, it doesn't provide any food for the birds, but it is a great dense cover for shelter.
And I want to, a listener called in, couldn't stay with us, but there is a Wisconsin program for the blind and visually impaired people. And it's called Birding by Ear. Birding by Ear.
Oh, great.
And Clara has posted it, the site up on our website, so ideas@WPR.org/Larry. If you go to today's date, you can find that website and go right to it, or you probably can Google it too. Birding by Ear is the
wonderful
name of it.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Appreciate them sharing the information.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that. Linda in Middleton has a question for us. Linda, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much. I love this program. This morning, we saw there was a dead squirrel on our sidewalk that wasn't there last night when my husband walked the dog. And we were wondering, he thought maybe a coyote, but I was thinking an owl. Would there be a difference in what the body looked like, depending on whether it was an owl or a coyote?
Was it eaten at all, Linda?
Yes, it was.
What part was eaten?
Fur.
I'm sorry, what part was eaten?
Well, I didn't inspect it.
Okay. It was just some fur that you saw?
Exactly.
Okay. First of all, owls, they are nighttime hunters, and squirrels are usually not active at that time.
Yeah.
So they're not a regular predator. Owls have an interesting habit, especially if they take rabbits, which is a pretty large prey item for a great horned owl. They'll decapitate them.
Yeah.
Because it's a heavy wing load for them to carry that kind of cargo, and they're not going to eat the head, so they'll sever that. And I remember one winter waking up and seeing something on the snow I could not identify. I had to get my binoculars out, and it was a rabbit head. So, yeah, coyote or even somebody's dog, probably the more likely predator on something like a squirrel.
Yeah, there you go.
Something that's out there very early in the morning, you know, or last thing of the, in the evening before dark.
Linda, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Anne in Caledonia, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Anne.
Hi, this is Anne. Well, you just answered one question because we did find a rabbit head in our yard, and I don't know what had happened.
There you are.
So I'm happy. I'm happy it's feeding the owl nearby. Say, we've had a trouble with birds hitting our window, and this is just an idea for other people. I was trying to find a quick way to fix it. And I put soap, just made some soap marks on the outside of my window. They've stayed all winter, and we have not had another bird hit our window. So just an idea for people out there who may have had that same problem.
Well, you raise a really good issue, and this is really becoming a serious concern among the conservation community, is certainly people are trying to attract birds to their own backyards, but windows are a source of pretty significant mortality for an awful lot of birds. It is something that just does not occur in nature in any other form. And birds will strike windows for two reasons. Either they're seeing a reflection of the tree's leaves in the window and think that they can just fly into a tree. Or if you have windows opposite each other, they think they can just shoot through that little opening. And when they strike that, they may die immediately, usually from broken neck, or birds will pick up and fly away, but the problem is we don't know what degree of internal injury they may have suffered in the meantime, yeah. And we don't know what the recovery rate is of those birds. So just because he's able to sort of shake it off and fly away does not mean that the bird always recovers completely. I've had the same problem at home a number of years ago. We enjoy our view out the windows, but we just felt terribly guilty of the fact that we're trying to feed and attract birds, and we had them hitting our windows. What I found as a solution is, and I'm not endorsing any one company over others, but it was out of Janesville, a Wisconsin company called Collide Escape. That's what I used. They provide something or manufacture something that's adhered to the window. They, I advertise it as one whole sheet to put over a window, but I found it really hard to see through. So I asked them to cut it in strips, half inch wide for the length of each window. I just measured up how tall those windows were top to bottom. And you put it 4 inches apart. Any physical barrier, whether it's yarn, string, something visible that they can see that's about 4 inches apart, should cut that down to almost zero. And it certainly did that for us. The reason is because 4 inches is a little too small for the songbirds to try to fly through. And so they're going to avoid that. They think that there's a physical obstruction that they just can't maneuver through. So anything you can do to put on those windows, and you've got to find something that is, first of all, quick, cheap, and easy to do. And also something that I think you can live with, because, you know, people have their windows because they want to enjoy the view. As I've mentioned to some people, well, you can paint all your windows black and you won't have anything strike the window, but yeah. you won't have a view either. So you got to find a nice compromise. But yeah, window strikes are a serious concern, and anything we can do, especially people who feed birds, yeah, try to do something to reduce that, because that thump on the window, it's more often than not, it's going to be fatal. And it's the last thing we want to do is enjoy the birds around our home and then find out that that very home is a source of mortality.
Yeah. And thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. She used soap. And she said it held all season.
Yeah. Now, in the past, remember people did the kestrel little silhouette, and they thought, oh, it looks like a predator and the birds won't hit it. They didn't identify it as a kestrel or a predator. And what happens is because you put a sticker here and a sticker there on a big window, they try to fly between that and they'll still hit them. So you need to have something, as I said, 4 inches apart or less that provides a visual barrier that the birds don't think they can go through. And it makes the window visible to them that there is something there they can't fly into and shouldn't.
Birding expert Bill Volkert, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, and he knows a lot about birds, and so we're having some fun talking with him. Our lines are filled right now. Let's go to Catherine in Milwaukee. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to know if the wren bird is a bird that I would see in Milwaukee.
House wren, yes, is a good possibility. They love the thickets and tangles, so they like to hide, you know, and feed among those kinds of shrubby areas or borders of shrubs. A little bit of shelter is important, but they are a cavity nester. They'll commonly take to a bluebird house. I've seen them nesting in natural cavities in trees and even in hollows on the side of old sheds. So, house wren is not that uncommon. It's a tiny bird, though, and all just brown mottled. So it's oftentimes well camouflaged and can be fairly secluded. It's got a very distinctive, very bubbly call. So it's oftentimes heard a lot easier than it is seen.
Yeah. So the house wren. There you go, Catherine. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Russ in Belleville. Your turn. Hi, Russ.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yesterday I saw a female cardinal that had lost her crest. She was almost bald. Do you have any idea what might have caused that?
Yeah, we tend to see that some birds more often than others, and cardinals seem to be somewhat susceptible, that kind of feather loss, especially on the head. There may be a more than one cause of that. Feather mites, an infestation, kind of like, say, mange would be for mammals, that's a possibility. Maybe some physical stress for the bird. But it probably isn't a long-term problem, except if they lose too much of that as insulation against extreme cold. Usually we see that recover pretty quickly.
There you go, Russ. Thank you for calling. John in Boaz, your turn. Hi, John.
Good morning. I'm wondering about loons in northern Wisconsin. I was up in Rhinelander, which is a 200-acre mill pond, with my canoe out in the middle, and I heard a loon calling off to the west. And he kept calling and calling. And then all of a sudden, I heard a loon off to the east, like about 1,000 feet apart. And he started calling, or he or she.
Mm-hmm.
Then this went on for like 3 minutes. They were calling back and forth. And then all of a sudden, they both swam towards the middle of the lake, and they dove down within 20 feet of each other. They dove down deep, and I didn't hear anything anymore. All of a sudden, I would say half a minute, they popped back up, and took off in separate directions. What did they do?
Okay. You will see some interaction among mated pairs calling back and forth to each other. like the cranes do, to establish a pair bond and a sort of a prelude to a mating. What you are describing sounds to me more like two competing males on opposite sides of the lake. And right in that middle must have been sort of the boundary of their territories that they're disputing over. And so, yeah, they're trying to reinforce a little bit where that line is, who's got what corner of the lake. And maybe they worked it out and then headed back to their own corners again. Loons, by the way, there's been a Project Loon Watch for many decades in Wisconsin. There's on any of the lakes where we have a nesting pair. There's always good information, so people are reminded to observe them from a distance, especially because our peak recreation period is nesting time for them. And that's when we don't want any disturbance. So enjoy them from a distance. And if you want a closer picture, get a bigger lens. But loons have actually been doing quite well in Wisconsin. We've actually got some nesting now moving south into the central part of the state. So it seems like they're expanding their territories a little bit to take advantage of some new lakes as homes. The main population still nests up in Canada, so we get a lot of migrants coming through here, as well as those that will settle down for the summer nesting period.
Yeah, you can see in the spring on Lake Monona in Madison, you might see 100 loons spread around the lake at any one time.
And they move north very quickly with the receding ice. Oftentimes in early spring, as we're in March, mid to late March, I have seen them flying overhead pretty high. And I've even seen them making big U-turns. I think what they're doing is reconnaissance. They're just looking for open water. How far is that starting to open up from the south into the north part of the state? And they move right along with that receding ice, and some of them try to push it. I've already seen a loon where a lake is barely one quarter open, and there's a loon on it right away. So, yeah, they move very quickly, and they're trying to get up those nesting grounds as fast as they can.
Let's hear the loon. Trina's got one for us.
That's that haunting call of the wilderness of the North Woods, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a, you never get tired of hearing call. Never get tired of it.
I think it somewhat underscores that atmosphere of the North Woods in spring and summer.
Gary in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Gary.
Yes, I was wondering, so as far as the hummingbird feeders, is there a better place, you know, a particular spot we should put them in the yard as opposed to other locations?
Okay, good question. I think you want to have them somewhat out in the open so they're visible to the birds. Some of my best places to hang them are where I've got some shrubs and trees right around the house. I get them visiting there, but I've also had friends who've had them out in the open. It seemed to attract larger numbers. So, yeah, you want them out there where the birds can actually see them. You get them a little bit too far under shelter, and they may be a little hard for the birds to find them. Good hint for you, best time to put up hummingbird feeders, 1st of May. It's that first week of May is when they tend to arrive. We may occasionally get a few, depending on a good strong south wind and warm weather at the end of April. But right along with the arrival of Baltimore ore, you can pretty well bet the first few days of May. So put it up there for those first arrivals. Get it ready at that time.
My friends Roger and Lynn, who live in northern Wisconsin, and he on Facebook, he'll post photos of ungodly numbers of hummingbirds at his feeders. And Roger goes through gallons and gallons of hummingbird food.
Yeah, well, whether you have just one visiting during the summertime or whether you've got a dozen or more, it's certainly nice to see. And, you know, it's always amazing to me that that tiny bird is a long-distance migrant. They're spending their winter right now down in Central America. So that's a long flight for a little guy like that.
Krista wonders where the best place in Milwaukee or close to Milwaukee is it to see a bounty duck?
Bounty. I'm not sure of anything of that name. I'm trying to find something similar.
I'm not either.
Yeah, if it's misspelled or mispronounced, anything that might sound similar to that. I'll roll that around in my head for an identification. But best waterfowl watching for Milwaukee is obviously going to be the lakefront.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of bird watchers that do regular visits to Grant Park, to South Shore Yacht Club, you know, those places right there. And the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology every year does a Lake Michigan shoreline field trip. And so as an organized tour, they'll just basically go from a couple of good sites, work their way right up that lakeshore and take a survey of things. People who live a little further north, right now, Port Washington has been quite hot. There are harlequin ducks there.
Oh.
That's a western bird, but spectacular. That's worthwhile seeing. And the red-breasted mergansers are starting to gather in good flocks out on the lake. The scaup, golden eye, they're all out there. So some good bird watching. And Sheboygan is another one. Manitowoc, Green Bay, just work your way right up there wherever you live. Yeah, some good sites to visit, some wonderful watching.
Chris wondered also about bird seed to attract wild birds. They're afraid of attracting mice and rats.
Oh, okay. Well, that's usually going to be what spills on the ground.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you want to keep a clean feeding station. It's easy to do when we've got a snow cover. You can just cover it up with more snow or just scoop it up once it's accumulated on the snow. And right now, as the snow is starting to melt, I'll do that where I see that if you get a big, thick layer, just shovel that and remove it. And it's not just for the fact that rodents might be coming in, but even more so the fact that birds who are feeding there are leaving their droppings, and you may have one that's carrying an infection like salmonella, and that can lead to a disease outbreak around your feeder. So just like anything else, you want to have some social distancing and some cleanliness, so keep your feeding stations clean. Your feeders, if they've been out for a good long time, next time they're empty, bring them in the house, wash them in warm water with a little bit of bleach, disinfect them, let them dry out completely and start over. And especially if you feed during the summertime, you want to do that. So we mentioned with hummingbirds, yeah, change that every so often, especially in the hot weather. We don't want that stuff to spoil and give them a bad meal.
No. Bill Volkert, our guest today, he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today as we talk birds and bird migrations with Bill. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Bill. I'm Larry Mueller. Talking birds and bird watching today on the show. Larry Mueller here with my guest Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years and has been watching birds for well over 40 years and has quite a long list. Bill, how many birds have you sighted?
Just over 4,200 species.
4,000. And how many do we have in Wisconsin?
Of regular occurrence, 300 plus, about 320 some that show up every year. And then there's some that show up every couple of years. And with a total list of all the rarities and lost birds, we're about 440 of all the stragglers that have ever been recorded. But I would say about 300 you can expect of pretty regular occurrence.
Yeah,
that's a pretty good rich variety of birds that keep you busy for a while.
Here's you with over 4,000.
Well, I've been saying but I've said for a long time, you know, if you follow the birds, they will take you to the most beautiful places on the planet. And to me, birds are not only a fascination in their own, but they're a window to the natural world. I see so much by looking for birds and enjoying them.
Yeah. Well, we have lots of people with questions for you, so let's go to Vicki in Danbury next. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. Thank you for this program. I had a follow-up question about hummingbirds. Mm-hmm. I've put out hummingbird feeders, and things seem to start well. But as the summer goes on, I notice like one of the birds sort of becomes a guard or a soldier and seems to push all the other hummingbirds away. Can you help me understand what that is and if there's something I could do differently?
They're like that.
Yeah, they'll get territorial, and sometimes it's the males that become quite aggressive and don't let others come to that feeder. If you've got a little bit of space in your backyard, maybe a separate second feeding station at a distance might be the way so you can split them up. I have sat outside trying to get pictures of hummingbirds coming to the feeder, and you'll just watch them battle, especially a little later in the season when they're no longer just tied right to a nesting area. You might have a little bit of movement among birds. You also have young ones added into the population. And sometimes it's hard to count if there's two, three, or four, because you'll see one there, somebody else comes in, chase them to make two laps around the house, and then shoot off into the yard, and something else buzzes by. It's all so fast and high speed. But, yeah, spread them out a little bit. Give them a second choice because, yeah, they will stand guard that and become quite aggressive.
Thanks, Vicki. Appreciate it. Paul at Spring Prairie, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a situation where I'm kind of out in the woods, and I bought a bat house on eBay from a local person that I was aware of, and it's almost like it's been too successful. The bats love it, but now it's creating a big mess. And I'd like to move it into the woods, but how do you do that?
What I would suggest is maybe, and I don't know how tied they are to that particular site, if you could give it a year, maybe you want to give them an alternate site or move it just a little bit of a distance at first, and then put up a second one, see if you can kind of get them to adopt that other site. Yeah, they've become quite traditional, and I don't know behavior of bats that well, that if you move it, whether they're so tied into that one particular site that they may not take advantage of something else that's been moved. If you move things, move them a little bit at a time and try that. But I'm really glad to hear that you're having such overwhelming success with bats, because they certainly have had a rough time of it. So, well, darn good for you. You know, keep it up.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it. Herbert in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Herbert.
Yes. Woodpecker damaged cedar siding. Have tried mothballs, sprayed insect repellent on the wood. Nothing seems to work. Help.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a tough one. And I can tell you that I used to advise an awful lot of people of things that basically came out of the literature of what to do about woodpeckers, and then they attacked my home.
Yeah.
It looks like the world's biggest tree to them. And what I found, I had a what they call T111 siding. It's a fir siding. And there were little holes pecked. And, I mean, you could hardly take a chalk line and make a straighter line than that. They went straight across in these rows. It was unbelievably symmetrical. What I think is it's not insects in the wood, but it's probing. In other words, you know, they don't hear insects moving around in the wood, but they just look for likely spots. You find a little hole, well, it's probably burrowed by an insect, so tap down in there and extract it. If they're living under the wood and growing up and then emerging, well, you just tap on likely spots. Find something that sounds a little hollow, well, maybe that's holding an insect. Dig down a bit, nope, not there, then go to the next one. Well, and then that's what you find, is that siding is soft wood and pretty easy for them, and they're exploring for possible food sources. I do not have an easy solution. Usually when birds start to do that on a home, whether it's pecking at a home or, say, if they start to do what I call shadow boxing, see their reflection in the glass, break that habit early. Problem is, you can't be there 24 hours a day to try to keep them away from it. And it's usually one bird that just gets a bad habit going. So I've had woodpeckers around, and a lot of them just don't bother. But when I do hear the tapping, I get out right away and try to chase them off the house and try to break that habit. Yeah, once they get into the habit, it is tough. And unfortunately, as we had a very early caller, they are protected by federal law. So to try to remove the woodpecker is both violation and would require a special permit to do so. And to try to reduce that damage, it is a challenge. That's all I can really say, and I feel sorry for you on that one. Maybe somewhere down the road go to vinyl, and I know it doesn't have quite the same look and appeal to it, but I can just sympathize with you. It is a real challenge, and I've had that problem in my home too. In fact, with just the last few years, we had to stain the house, and we patched up holes, and I'm talking about 800 to 1,000 little holes that we patched all over, and then we stained the house. I have not seen them come back yet, so whoever had the bad habits has not returned. That bird has probably passed on, and I'm hoping somebody else doesn't fill in his place. So all I can say is good luck with it. It can be a real serious challenge, though, and cedar is something that they seem to really go for.
Love.
Yeah. And I know Scott Craven has talked about that in the past, too, and there is no quick, easy fix.
No, you can drape You can, there, you know, netting or some sort mm-hmm. over the
from some
the,
physical barrier.
Yeah, you can try a physical barrier yeah. just to get them to quit doing mm-hmm. it. But that's about.
Well, and it's kind of like a bird that sees its reflection in a glass. You can try that on one window, too. It doesn't mean he just goes around the corner to the next window either. So,
yeah, somebody put up a mirror in a tree nearby and got the woodpecker going over to that mirror and spending time with it.
Give him some distraction and something else to zero in on, yeah.
Herbert, that's the best we got
for
you.
Yeah, we can wish you good luck, and that's all I can say.
Dot in Chippewa Falls, on to you. Hi, Dot.
Hey, I have a suggestion that has helped me get rid of woodpeckers because they like to peck up towards the top of the house on the siding on the corner.
Yeah.
I take small pieces of glass. You can attach them to, like, fish line and yeah. hang them up there where they are pecking.
So a little bit of a distraction again, kind of like what Larry said with the mirror or yeah. something else that if it's moving in the wind or something that reflects a little bit, it may be a visual distraction or barrier for them. Yeah,
yeah, that's yeah. a good idea, Dot. Thank you very much for calling.
If there was one single quick fix that always worked, I would pass it on to you. But that's the challenge, unfortunately, with something like this. Everything's a little different case.
Thanks again, Dot. Dave and Nina, we go to you now. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I live west of town in an old Christmas tree farm and have been very successful in putting out multiple features for songbirds. I quit last summer when I had a family of hawks move in, and I noticed them dining on the songbirds on my porch. Mm-hmm. I didn't feed last summer. I haven't seen the hawks recently. Can I go back to feeding birds again?
Yeah, that's a good question. And this is something that we hear quite a bit of people who have a bird feeding station is it's great. You know, birds are coming in. You're attracting them. It's very successful. And then a Cooper's hawk, which is the most common culprit, comes in and snatches a brilliant cardinal right off the feeder, which can be disheartening. The real challenge here is he's coming in because you're just making it easy to hunt. And first of all, keep in mind that most of the bird feeding we do is not critical to the bird survival. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of natural food out there. It's just convenient. I can oftentimes compare it to, say, fast food. It's quick. It's easy. It's there. So that's why they take advantage of it. Well, if you have the birds coming in there and flocking, especially where they're away from shelter, it makes the hunting really easy for that hawk. And why should he quit as long as it's easy feeding for him? Shut down the station. Let the birds disperse. They'll move out and find food somewhere else. They'll spread out a little bit. His luck goes down. He'll move on. The only time that doesn't happen is they happen to be nesting right in the neighborhood. So that yeah. usually goes until about midsummer when the young fledge from the nest and then disperse. And in summertime is the most abundant food sources for birds, so it's not critical, though it is always fun to feed them year-round. But if you do have it, especially this time of year, I usually say about 2 weeks. Shut down the station and then start it up again. Yeah, give it a shot, and most likely that bird has moved to somewhere else to try his luck some other neighborhood.
Thanks, Dave, for calling. Younger listener Charlie from Janesville joins us next. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. My question is, I live in Wisconsin. How do you attract blue buntings?
Blue bunting. Now, we have the indigo bunting. That is a spring migrant. Usually the first week of May is when they show up. And what's interesting is they like the small seeds, like the millet seeds and cracked corn. So they'll come to a feeder, but most often you're going to hear people say they come for 2 weeks and then you disappear. Well, that's because they're just waiting for the natural food. And I've had a lot of questions. Where do they leave after that? Well, they're just moving into the treetops. So those birds are actually common summer nesters, especially along forests and forest edges. They'll visit the feeders when they first arrive. They're looking for food, which is not yet completely out for the year. But once that food emerges, they'll find more than enough natural food. The way I tend to find them, especially once the leaves come out, they're hard to find, and that's by song. So when the bird first shows up on a feeder, that brilliant indigo blue is, you know, certainly attractive and easy to see. But also keep in mind that blue color is reflected light. So unless the light is actually shining directly on them, if they're overhead, they're going to look black. And if they're hiding in a tree, you won't see them at all. So we identify them by song as we get into later spring and summer.
Yeah, maybe Trina's got an indigo bunting.
Indigo bunting. Two fast repeated notes. Up, down, very bubbly.
Yeah, let's see if we've got it here.
Nope. That sounds more like house finch to me.
Yeah, that does sound like house finch.
But it's a real rapid two notes and usually very bubbly up, down. So you're going to hear something of a rhythm. And usually ending going up a little bit. And as I say, it's something that most people are going to experience for just 2 weeks in springtime, and then they seem to disappear. I've had a few visits throughout the summer, but there again, it's one that just finds it convenient and makes it a habit, more the exception.
So it's not the best. Another colorful bird is the bluebird.
Yes, there's another blue-colored bird. They're a little bit more of the open country. The big concentrations are going to be central Wisconsin, the big open sweeps in Wisconsin. And there they've had some tremendous success from, say, the outskirts of Madison up toward Stevens Point for nesting. Also over toward Eau Claire, some of those large glacial plains and open sweeps. Those are some real attractive areas. Bluebirds are not deep forest birds. Even northern Wisconsin, where we've got openings, you can find them. And they can be attracted to the nest boxes. The Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin, another good website to go by. If you've got suitable habitat or even questioning what that might be for criteria, go to that website, take a look. They have nest box designs, how to set them up, monitor them, manage them, and to care for bluebirds.
Yeah, the association dear to my heart. And Charlie, thanks a lot. And if you're a golfer, Charlie, there are a couple of golf courses. I know the Portage Country Club has many bluebird houses up, and the University Ridge Golf Course has many bluebird houses set up along fairways.
Oh, there we go, yes.
And it's fun to see bluebirds when you're out there. So that's another one, Charlie. Thank you so much for calling.
Nice to hear from a young birder.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate it. Well, Jeff in Superior, we'll give you a chance. Jeff, thank you.
Thank you. It's a beautiful day up here. I have a springtime story I want to share. It was the first Saturday in May years ago, and we have bird feeders and nests throughout the yard. And we were watching the Kentucky Derby on TV, and about 10 minutes before the race, a bird came up to the window and started pecking at the glass, and like as if it was fighting a reflection or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, and I believe in the great spirit, so I said, oh, that's a clue for the race. So I put $20 to win on Mind That Bird, and the horse won.
It was a
and
sign. It's a sign.
I think the bird was telling us, you know, bet on the horse. With
put
the
your
bird
money
your
on
name.
This guy.
I love it.
Story.
Hey, thanks, Jeff. That's a great
story. Should
have
bought a lottery ticket, too.
Oh, my goodness me. Thanks so much. That's a wonderful story. Well, let's try Mark in La Crosse next. Hi, Mark.
Well, it's not quite fair following that last call. we are interested in trying to find a place in Wisconsin where we can hear loon calls. So we're looking for a place, and we're looking for a time frame for this spring.
Okay. I would wait until, probably getting into May. They're going to be up there a little bit sooner, but they're also going to take a little while before the migrants move out. They settle in for nesting, and they start calling a little bit more vigorously, especially into those evening hours. You can hear that echo across the lakes. It just creates that North Woods summer evening atmosphere. I would suggest the big flowages. There's good numbers over on Turtle Flambeau, on the Chippewa flowage. And because you have big bodies of water and all these endless bays, there's a lot of little isolated areas where you can have more than one pair out there. And some of these may harbor, you know, a dozen pair or more. So those are some of my favorite spots for them. There's a lot of lakes in northern Wisconsin, Carson. Well, there's thousands of lakes to begin with, but a lot of them that host loons, but it may be a single pair on a lake, and that's going to be sort of hunt and peck as to which lake is going to be hosting a particular family of loons up there. But, yeah, if you've got a chance, get out on the flowages, get yourself a canoe or kayak, paddle around. You can camp on the islands out there, which makes a wonderful time.
Yeah, the turtle flambeau.
And, yeah, and just sit back in the evening, enjoy that. And as we said earlier, you can get out and also paddle around and photograph them, but give them the space they need.
You might do a little fishing along the way.
That's right.
Quite a lot of fish in the Turtle Flambeau flowage and the Chippewa flowage. Big bodies of water, thousands of acres.
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Lots of islands to camp on and, and just to recreate a little bit and just sit and sit back and, as you say, enjoy the sounds.
Yes.
Let's see. We've got Barbara in Milwaukee who wonders which bird feathers are legal to possess. Say you find a bird feather.
Okay. The only ones are those birds where there is a hunting season for. So, in other words, waterfowl, pheasants, and turkeys. And you're going to see a lot of craft items with turkey feathers. First of all, they're very colorful. There's a variety of both the body feathers, wing, tail feathers that have little different patterns to them. And because it is a hunted species, you can actually possess the feathers. I'm not going to get into it too far, but what actually happens is, I said earlier, all birds are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Well, so are the ducks. But what happens is every year, the federal government puts in the Federal Registry the season for that year and the regulations. In other words, what that is an exemption to it. In other words, it's saying that at this time of year, these birds we recognize are protected by federal law, but we will allow the hunters between these dates and these dates to go out to take these birds, and then you can possess it. You can actually then eat the bird, mount it, put it there, or have the feathers, or fly tying also. People will use those, but it's only the game species. Unfortunately, and people are tempted this, an owl flies by and leaves a feather laying on a trail. By the letter of the law, you really can't pick that up and stick it in your hat. Because the problem is, if somebody's investigating as to how you came into possession, is that just a feather that was shed, or is that a bird that was maliciously, illegally harvested to pluck the feathers? We can't tell. And even a roadkill, you can't just pluck the feathers off. So technically, those are violations.
And from Madison, had a hummingbird guard that doesn't let others use their feeders. But this one was a female. The occasional male is more timid.
Either one, if they find a good food source, they will defend it. And in fact, if you get into Central South America, where we have more species of hummingbirds, I've been at sites where there are some very attractive flowering shrubs for hummingbirds. And yet the rare ones, the smaller ones, are hardly ever seen because you'll have one bird who's the bully. He'll keep everyone out. And if others try to come in, you better be quick because he's not going to be around long. He'll get driven right off of that. So, yeah, they make very aggressive and very possessive of those food sources, whether it's a flowering bush or, it's a hummingbird feeder.
And Mary in Eastern Iowa County called, couldn't stay with us. She saw a pair of what she thinks are ferruginous hawks. Near her home, aren't they supposed to be out west?
Yes, a ferruginous hawk is a western bird. They're not here yet. It's a long-distance migrant. We have the broadwing hawk in the eastern United States that will winter down in Mexico, Central and South America. Ferruginous hawks will go all the way down as far as Argentina, very long migrants, and are a western bird. I have seen them in Wisconsin. A pair I would be a little skeptical of. It would be the stray individual that we might have. Rough-legged hawks are here right now. That's a northern visitor for winter.
Yeah.
In fact, my drive down here, I came across Horicon Marsh, and there was a light phase rough leg circling right over the highway. That's another one to be watching for.
Pat in Elm Grove emailed us. This has to do with the woodpeckers beating on the house. They were beating on her house, and she put up a suet feeder, Pat did, and that took care of the woodpecker problem.
Give them an actual food source.
Gave that woodpecker an actual food source, and I think that's worth a try.
I would pass anything on that seems to work for someone. It may not work in all cases, but, yeah, just keep working on it because, obviously, it can get expensive and very frustrating.
Always a pleasure, Bill. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's entirely my pleasure. Thank you, and thanks to everyone out there.
Bill Volkert, a retired wildlife educator and naturalist, and he'll come back and we will do this again. Coming up tomorrow, some Wisconsin folks want you to join a citizen seed trial to help breed the best local seeds possible. That's tomorrow for Garden Talk. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.